I'm Yardley.
And I'm Zibby.
And these are the mini-sodes.
They're bite-sized
stories about
true crime.
That's it. Zibby and Yardley follow up with Lieutenant Scott about where the women from the sociopath and the whistleblower are now.
So, Scott, thanks for coming back to chat with us. We've been so curious, as have our listeners, about the women from the sociopath and the whistleblower. Where are they all now? Do you know? Do you keep up with them?
Myself and a lot of these women establish quite a bond, and so when they're in trouble, especially those who are still out there and vulnerable, I'm their trusted sort of confidant.
What about Lisa, the one who lived in the pay-by-the-week motel with her daughter?
Right, the one who had the crucial piece of DNA saved in a pair of rolled-up sweatpants.
Yeah, so I heard from Lisa recently. I hear from her once in a while. Tragically, she's still sort of in trouble. You know, she's kind of one of those people who's kind of in jeopardy and vulnerable, and I think has probably fallen through that sort of social service gap because she's not...
She's just not really taking care of herself, is she?
Yeah. She's the kind of person who I think that she could really benefit from mental health attention and therapy, and she got a settlement in the end. I remember she bought a house. You know, she had a daughter, and so I think she had plans to try and resurrect her relationship with her daughter, but without sort of a chaperone or a manager, she just couldn't help herself. And of course, she's surrounded in her world by pirates. And so as soon as they see that she's in line to get some money, they were all over her. And
like vultures.
Yeah, exactly. And so I remember that she had bought a house and that the house had burned down and that she was out homeless and that she had told me, she called me and told me that she had been sexually assaulted. And I remember directing resources to her and having an officer contact her and take a report. But she's a complicated person because she truly is mentally ill and she has a lot of history. So I think she's somebody who tells these crazy stories. And a lot of times there's truth in there, but I think sometimes it's hard to find. And of course, as I mentioned during the course of this investigation, that I was impacted by that sort of life experience and bias. And so I think I had a hard time hearing it, but she proved that there was truth to her stories that seemed so unbelievable. And that proof came out in that DNA. But to answer your question, she's still there. She's in trouble.
Oh, that breaks my heart to hear. I do think of her a lot because she was such an unabashed, colorful, and keen character throughout this case.
Yeah, and there's such raw truth to her, you know. She just is a remarkable person who
really seemed to have a good moral compass, right? Despite some of the decisions she made throughout her life.
You know, I remember in court, like I had talked about, you never knew what she was going to say, but that there was a truth that came about the way she told and talked about things because it was like, who can make this stuff up?
She didn't have any choice. She wasn't that clever. She really just, it all just came out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what about Terry, the one who made the initial call?
I have not heard from her. She, early on, she was really the whistleblower. And she was a foundational witness and character because she was somebody who was mature, who had, like many of the women in this case, been around the block and had life experience and street experience. And I think she was the kind of personality that some of these women needed as a support person. And so she was kind of, I don't know, sort of grandmotherly, you know? And some of the younger girls I know sort of migrated to her when things were going on. And so I have a sense that she succeeded, that I think that she moved forward. I talked to her about the fact that I go around and do training and that kind of thing. And so she was more than happy to allow me to share her story. And I just have a sense that she went on to experience some success and some fulfillment after this entire dramatic, life-changing event.
I wonder if she'll ever hear this podcast. It's such a strange thing to think about.
Yeah, and what about Janine, the one who had that horrific night with Robert in the park bathroom?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
Janine, yeah. She was the most significant victim. She was victimized the most. She was a, for lack of a better term, favorite. She is the one that had been a paralegal. In Southern California and had worked for an attorney and had a degree and came to our town and got hooked on heroin and just went downhill.
Right.
And Robert, every chance he got, he victimized her. And so during the process of the civil suit that followed, she received a settlement of $750,000. And so she had children, and I really had high hopes for her that she would go places and do things. And I know that, that was something that she wanted to do, but her children had been, I think, taken in by the family because of her substance abuse. And she became ill shortly after she received her settlement. She'd had access to her settlement for a period of time. And her mother contacted me after her death and said that she had been, she had gotten an infection as a result of going back and using intravenous drugs. Uh-huh. And so she was using heroin again. And I think she got an infection and it turned septic and she passed away.
Oh, God.
Ugh. What happened to her settlement money? Were her kids able to benefit from any of it?
Well, her mom told me that between the medical expenses and what she had blown through the process was gone. All but it was all gone.
Ugh. The fallout is never ending.
And her mother, you know, I know that her mother cared for her deeply and that she was at her side during the trial. But again, you know, addiction is that haunting, always there sort of monster. And as soon as you have access to candy,
sure.
If somebody's not there to hold your hand, I think it's a fallback. Easily, mm-hmm. You can get pulled back in.
What about Anna, the one who worked at the cell phone kiosk in the mall?
Right, the underage girl.
Yeah.
She's contacted me a couple of times, and I know that she's gone back to school to finish her degree. I know that she was had interest in social work.
Hmm.
So she's always struck me as a very together, smart girl.
She had a lot of wherewithal in that, in her dealings with Robert, you know, I mean, she was the one who kept putting him off and saying, that's not me, I'm not going there.
Right? Yeah, I think she was very strong moral character. But again, the damage that he did with her, especially under the circumstances where she had really felt like, I think she was in control. And she didn't realize that she was dealing with a lion. Right.
Right.
So she felt like she had it under control and he finally persisted and got to her.
That is so awful.
Despicable. How about the girl Jeannie, who Robert pulled over for drunk driving? She had the friend in the car and he sent her off to drunkenly drive her friend home and then drunkenly drive back to meet him downtown at a restaurant to strike a, quote, deal.
Yeah, Jeannie. So I see Jeannie as well. And she is somebody who I had been around even before, and I didn't realize that there was a sort of a third-party connection.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, my partner, Dennis, she had babysat for him.
Really?
When his kids were little. And so just that sort of strange, odd, small-town connection, you know. But so I still see her. We always exchange pleasantries. And again, it's not something we talk about, but we have that sort of, I don't know, it's almost like a brother-sister sort of bond, I think, that you develop with people, you know?
Sure.
And where I guess I'm the sort of big brother, you know, the protector, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Was there ever any follow-up on Rebecca, the one with the short-term memory loss?
She was, she had been in assisted living when this all happened. And because she didn't have the ability to recall, we always surmised that she was victimized. And of course, she wouldn't have been able to participate in the prosecution. So I think in some ways, I guess she's blessed in that she doesn't know what happened to her.
What about the second Lisa, the one who had been held at gunpoint on the passenger side floor of Robert's patrol vehicle while Robert chatted it up with another officer? Remember that?
Yeah. So since this case, I moved to the neighboring small town. So I see her still. She's still active, I think, in the criminal world. I think that she's vulnerable that way. Mm-hmm. I don't mean criminal in the sense that she's a criminal. I think that she's out there and vulnerable. And I think that she, because of her addiction to heroin, I think that she commits crimes to feed that habit. And, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, we're talking about a pretty big segment of society out there, that sort of underworld. And she's still kind of engaged in that underworld. Mm. Yeah. She recognizes me and, you know, I've waved to her and I've talked to her a couple times, you know.
Does she wave back?
Yeah. Yeah. with all her fingers.
That's
yeah.
sort of nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's, I mean, like I've talked about, I mean, this whole process has been one of those situations where I've made friends where you wouldn't think that you'd necessarily find them.
Yeah. Sure. And what became of Jessica and all those other women at the jail who practically lined up to tell you their stories about Robert?
So, you know, my name is still recognized locally in drug treatment and that kind of thing, because my recollection is Jessica and some of the women that she would have found herself in that women's prison with. This was one of those historic cases that I think gets sort of passed on to generations even, you know?
Sure. Mm.
And so it's almost like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, it's been a credential for me in some ways when you have this sort of impenetrable barrier that a lot of times exists between police and witnesses. And
sure.
And
you can sort of break the snitch code a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think... And, you know, it wasn't through any deliberate process. It just sort of happened. But I think I have that. I've kind of developed that credential that way.
Well, you did switch sides. I mean, by your own admission, you know, you started out feeling really suspicious. This can't possibly be true. He's one of our own. And then you really became the advocate and the champion for these women. That's got to be a really big deal for them. I don't think, it seems to me a lot of people hadn't done that for them.
Yeah, I'm proud of it. I mean, it was I think I was unwitting that way, you know. But it is something that I think of all the cases that I've been involved in, I think I know I'm the most proud of that.
Yeah, you should be. And in a way, your work in this investigation and you sharing the story is still doing really great work on a bigger scale. A lot of listeners wrote in after hearing the series to express how much they appreciated this story for a number of reasons. Outside of the general entertainment factor of hearing true crime, it ended up being incredibly educational. People talked a lot about how powerful it was to hear about the behavioral patterns of a sociopath, of a sexual predator.
Yeah, it was really, it meant a lot to them. And to get such an inside view of what you all see.
Yeah, pretty amazing case.
Small Town Dicks is produced by Zibby Allen and Yardley Smith for Paperclip Limited.
This minisode was edited by Soren Bajan, Logan Heftel, Yardley Smith, and Zibby Allen.
Music for the show was composed by John Forrest. Our associate producer is Aaron Gaynor, and our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell.
If you like what you hear and want to stay up to date with the show, consider visiting us at smalltowndicks.com.
And feel free to subscribe to us on YouTube to see trailers for past and forthcoming episodes.